Good. This is another in a continuing series of oral history interviews that are being conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit, Galvin Library, Illinois Institute of Technology. Today is the 22nd of August, 2018, and we are in the library's Donnelly Room. I am Ralph Pugh, University Archivist, co-conducting this interview with Adam Strome, Director of University Archives and Special Collections. Today's guest on this day is Sandy,
please.
Marcus, connected with the Institute and College of Psychology programs here at IIT, stretching back to the
long way.
It's in your DNA. Yeah. You can't pass tense
absolutely.
On this anymore.
Absolutely.
Back to the early 1960s. You retired from here on the 30th of June,
a few months ago,
2018,
correct.
With the title, just for the record, of Career Development Consultant, and that was under the Career Services Unit here at IIT. But you go back to the late 60s in terms of your degrees. You were, in terms of the highlights of your career here, you were the director of the Institute of Technology's Counseling Center from 77 to 86, a partner in the Institute for Psychological Services from 1977 to 2006. You have a two-page, resume here with with all the permutations of your involvement.
Yeah.
And we know you have much to say, so I'm going to open up the floor to you, prefacing it by saying, yeah, we do want to hear about you know, right from the beginning, you're a Chicagoan born.
Yes.
Why you chose this field, how you got into IIT, what was the nature of the profession of psychology or the teaching of psychology here when you came on board? Who were some of the notables?
Indeed.
And then moving forward.
Indeed. Thank you so much. I gave this opportunity some thought, and I'm going to go back and mention somebody who will come in actually later into my life, but he had an IIT connection. This is my late stepfather. His name was Harry G. Hershenson. He was a graduate of Kent Law School. Are you ready? 1920. He became a pretty successful lawyer in Chicago in the 1920s and 30s. A lot of corporate work and some work in court, etc. At the beginning of World War II, he tried to enlist in the Army, but because of his age, he was already in his early 40s or so. It took him a while, actually, to get in. He was finally accepted into the United States Army. He rose to this is during World War II. He rose to the rank of a lieutenant colonel. He was with the Army as the U.S. Army marched through Italy, and as it liberated all these towns and villages, they put these guys in charge. And he ran at various points, Milan, Naples. When Mount Vesuvius erupted in 1944, Harry was in charge of the entire evacuation. It was all on his shoulders. He was up for 5 days and nights without sleep. He was knighted twice by the Pope. He had two papal knighthoods. He was very proud of those because Harry was, of course, Jewish. And he claimed to be the only Jew ever twice knighted by a Pope. Who knows whether that's true or not, but it's a great story. He was very proud of that.
Yeah.
When I was a graduate student here, Harry was single. My mother was single. They met. They fell in love, and Harry, after the war, became a Cook County judge for 25 years. Christine and I, we met because of IIT, by the way. We were married in 1968. In fact, a few days next week, on September 1st, is going to be our 50th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
And we were married by Harry. He was dating my mother at the time. We were married in his courtroom.
Okay.
It was like getting sentenced, but that's another story. But at any rate, he was a wonderful man. Harry was also one of the original founders of the Civil War Roundtable. Mm-hmm. Carl Sandburg was a good friend of his.
Mm-hmm.
He had an incredible collection of books, periodicals, and things, and authentic things signed by Grant, and unbelievable, yeah. from the Civil War.
Yeah.
That collection he and mother donated to Kent Law School. It's now in their library.
Oh,
it's
really?
The Harry and Anita Hershenson collection.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Associated with the Civil War Roundtable for
correct.
Many years.
That's correct. Right. So I have, and here's some information about him and talking about his donation to mm-hmm. Kent Law School. There's a picture of he
good.
And my mother.
Just for the record, you don't mind your birth month being
out? Oh, not at all. Not at all.
July of 1941.
July 31st, 1941.
There you go.
So
okay.
I just celebrated my 77th. So I tell people, I can't believe it. A third of my life is over.
God,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's an IIT connection here
okay.
with Harry. And there's also a faculty connection. I'll get into that. So I grew up on the northwest side of Chicago. I'm a graduate of Von Steuben High School. My mother, for when I was a kid and in high school and most of college until she married Harry, was the secretary to a then world-famous pediatric neurologist. His name was Meyer Perlstein. And he ran old Fantas Clinic here at Cook County Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
He was literally one of the leading authorities in the world on cerebral palsy.
Mm-hmm.
He founded the Medical Society for Study of Cerebral Palsy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hanging around his office for a good deal of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And my grades through grammar school, high school, and college. I went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and they pioneered in the cooperative education work study. My grades were okay.
Mm-hmm.
They were above a C average, between a C and a B average.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally I'd do real well in some course, but never really outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
My prime love was classical music, and especially violin playing. I've played the violin since I was a kid. And I'm an amateur, but I take it seriously. Anyway,
yeah.
But I had in college no idea what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I really medicine intrigued me, but at the same time, my math skills were not great,
mm-hmm.
and the thought of going to medical school wasn't appealing. But it was either that I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of months before I graduated, I was sitting in my dorm room trying not to read a book,
mm-hmm.
and a bunch of my buddies and friends came by, guys and gals, and said, "Hey, we're all going to go see a movie. There was one movie theater in this little town. you want to come along?" I said, "You bet." I put the book down.
Mm-hmm.
We go to the movie theater, and the movie was a movie called The Mark, which had a very challenging theme for its day. It was the hero of the movie, is played by Stuart Whitman,
mm-hmm.
had some tendencies towards some pedophilia,
mm-hmm.
a very challenging topic for the day.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And there was a part in there for his psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you know, people in my field and psychology and clinical psychology and psychiatry aren't portrayed very well, usually. This was different.
Oh, really?
He had a key role in this film, and the role he took, and it was the actor was Rod Steiger, who was a fabulous actor, usually played villains, but in this one,
mm-hmm.
he was unbelievable. And he played the role of everybody's favorite grandfatherly, interpersonal counselor, just what you liked. And I looked at that, I still remember that to this day, and I looked at that movie, and it suddenly clicked. I know what I want to do. Literally, overnight. I walked out of that theater and I said to my friends, "I know what I want to do." I called Dr. Perlstein the next day, and I said, "Hey, I want to, I know what I want to do. I want to be a psychologist. Can I talk to Eli?" Now, Eli Lippman was a psychologist that he used for his practice, so I knew this guy from the time he was a kid, but we never talked much, you know, just socially, you know. Mm-hmm. He and his wife were both psychologists. And he taught it at University of Illinois here when it was at Navy Pier. So I called Eli, and he said, oh, and he asked me about my grades. Mm-hmm. And I told him, she said, well, that may be a problem, but he said, our two best friends, Gene and I, our two best friends, we go on vacations with them, are Phil and Harriet Schuriger. Phil Schuriger is the chair of the psychology department at IIT, and Harriet was on the faculty. And I said, IIT has a psychology department? You know, as you know, people still don't know that. And it's always been a good one, always been a good one. He said, let me talk to them. In the meantime, Dr. Perlstein called me in, and he was familiar with my birth record, and he asked me, I was born, the day I was born, I'm lucky to be here at all. I was born not breathing. I was what they called in those days a blue baby. I hovered between life and death my first day of life. I spent half the time in an incubator. I'm lucky to be here at all. That's what Dr. Perlstein told me. He said, second luckiest thing is you should have been one of my patients with a condition like CP or whatever. The third thing is, he asked me in detail how I studied, and I told him. And he said, looking at your birth history and looking at what you're telling me about how you've studied, you've done pretty well. I think you got a learning disability. And in those days, that was the beginning of that era. He was one of the people really early into looking at that. He arranged for me to get tested at Northwestern at their clinic, and they found a learning disability. I have a visual perceptual disorder. I have poor visual memory. I can't see numbers in my head. I mean, I can see 16 and 15 if I add them together. I look at the 16, I look down at the 15, and 16 is gone. In my mind's eye, right now, I can't see all the details of my wife's face. My vision. So I have compensated, I overcompensated auditorily and in other ways conceptually. And it got me through, but it also made the problem more invisible. On the basis of that, my work with the psychologist there, I totally changed the way I studied. And when I started at IIT, my grades went straight up. Now,
you start here in the fall of 64?
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, how did that happen?
Yes.
Given all this.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
I talked to Eli, and he said, he got filled in on my learning situation, too. And he called me back. This was in about a month after I graduated. Less than that. And he said, okay, I've talked to Phil and Harriet. They're willing to take you in as a provisional student at IIT, provided you do well. And my first year was full-time undergraduate psych courses, because I had only two psych courses in college. And fortunately, I did very well. Now, a semester's worth, a year's worth, of full-time undergraduate psych courses, if that's not enough to drive you out of the field, nothing is, okay? So the Schurigers were happy with me. I was in seventh heaven, okay? So that's how I got into IIT. I don't think there's anybody I can think of who would have gotten into a school like this as a favor to the friend.
From a faculty member. Was Dr. Perlstein related to Harris Perlstein of Perlstein Hall?
No.
Did not.
Okay. I don't think there's any relation there.
Okay, well,
similar
to
being
clear on that.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
Now, one of the faculty, it happened to be named Hershenson, and he had a distant relation, Dave Hershenson. He was distantly related to the judge, Harry Hershenson. So I have these indirect connections here. But at that point, I didn't know anything about Harry Hirschinson. So as a student here, I got into a volunteer situation one day a week with a day treatment center for severely disturbed autistic and schizophrenic children, and Christine was volunteering there. That's where I met her.
Okay.
And the assistant director of the school, I got my friend Harvey, you know, my buddy from Canada, interested in that. Mm-hmm. So we both volunteered over there, and the assistant director of the school, Chris, was actually living with her. She was like her live-in babysitter. And Harvey married her. Her name was Dorothy. And she eventually got a PhD in psychology also. So Harvey and I were roommates, and we married roommates. She's also deceased, unfortunately. She died a year after Harvey of cancer. At any rate, and the four of us were a foursome for a long time. And he turned into one of my best friends. Harvey was a gifted athlete. He was a hockey player. And his undergraduate was at, the university in Canada? Anyway, he was their star hockey player. And he used to pick up extra money when we were students. And I'd watch him several times as a referee for semi-pro games. And he was usually the best skater on the ice. And he got an offer while we were graduate students to go to the hockey referee training program. He could have been in the NHL, and he turned it down. And I said, Harvey, listen, like a once-in-a-lifetime offer. You can always come back and get your degree. And he said to me, nah, he said, the clinical experience, the clinical program here is satisfying all my needs for violence. He had a wonderful sense of humor. We really hit it off, and we learned a lot. Some of the faculty here, the major one who influenced both of us, was Robert M. Roth.
Okay.
Robert M. Roth wrote a classic paper in 1963. He was then at, I think, Harper College, not the one here, one in the South somewhere. Anyway, it was called the non-achievement syndrome. He identified a certain type of academic underachiever. And he came here with a whole theory and a whole program in mind. And the only place his theory has been fully published was in our first book, The Psychology of Underachievement. Okay. The complete theory is in there, including a theory that Harvey and I concocted, a theory of differential diagnosis, which we're very proud of. At any rate, Bob Roth was one of the best clinicians I have ever met. He was my mentor and Harvey's. And other people too, and I guess David Hirschinson was also on the faculty, and so I had a wonderful 5 years here. I got my Maury Aderman was one of my teachers. He was my advisor for my master's, and Bob Roth was my advisor for my doctorate, and so I went through and I graduated and didn't know quite what to do after that. So I had a number of positions. I worked for the State of Illinois Department of Mental Health. I also, for about 6 years, was a psychologist for a very large pediatric practice. So I worked, so I got a good grounding in all kinds of stuff. And had a lot of good experiences. And then in 1977, my buddy Jot Friedland was the Dean of Counseling Services here for IIT. You'll find his name somewhere. He's still alive. He's still around if you want to talk to him.
Okay.
I'll give you his number. And Jotty, he and I were very good friends and buddies and everything, but he was the Dean of, now, in those days we did not have a wellness center. There was no wellness center. So he, well, the things that reported to him were the counseling center and the freshman advising program and things like that, the campus physician.
Okay.
And most of us were all over in Far Hall.
Okay.
Jotty was also the director of IPS, IPS was the Institute for Psychological Services, and you should know something about that for the history of IIT. Mm-hmm. A psychologist named George Speer founded the Institute for Psychological Services as part of IIT. It was one of IIT's institutes in 1945. It did two things. One of them, which one of them was really very rare in those days, they did complete comprehensive career counseling. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Testing, they test people for 3 days. Mm. And interviews, multi-interviews. When I came in as counseling center director in 1977, I also was simultaneously associate director of IPS. So I started getting involved at that point in my career with career counseling.
So IPS, IPS is the root then of all this industrial, professional, or corporate psychology that continues to this day.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
One of the other people trained through that program was George Langlois.
Right, right.
Okay?
Yeah.
In fact, he in the years I was counseling center director, he actually came to work for me.
Okay.
And then in the last few years, I've been working for him. So turnabout fair play. Yeah. He's a great guy.
Oh, yeah. We've interviewed him.
Oh, he's wonderful. He's wonderful. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Now, in those years, Bob Roth had a counseling program aimed at academic underachievers. Mm-hmm. And I should say who we defined as academic underachievers. If you take a group, all underachievement means is there's a gap between one's potential and their performance. Mm-hmm. That's essentially all it means. Mm-hmm. We defined underachievers as those for whom that gap is significant and chronic, and for whom there's no other significant medical or psychological or situational problem that's the cause, because those are treated in those disciplines.
Yes. Right.
So if you take a group of students who are underachieving and you remove learning disabilities, epilepsy, severe emotional disturbance, situational problems, etc., you're left with a group of students who just simply underachieve. That was our group.
Okay?
And in those years, and Roth came here in about 63, 64, just before I came in. In those years, we had one of the only successful counseling programs for academic underachievers in the country.
Okay. All right.
I don't know if we have time to get into the theoretical model, but I don't want to bore you anyway. But it was really something. Anyway, So that was my training, both very heavily in clinical testing, and especially working with motivational issues.
All right. Just to flesh out the physicality of it.
Oh, please.
So you graduate with your PhD
in 1969. Yeah.
So you're off campus from then until till 77.
That's correct.
Okay.
And from then, in those years, I did a number of things. Not much with IIT. I taught one or two courses here, as an instructor.
I was brought in as an adjunct. Okay.
For a year or two before I became counseling center director, I was the assistant director to Andy Beck. She was the director at that time.
Okay.
And when she left, Jody asked me to become director.
Okay, good. Okay. Before we leave the 60s entirely, what was it, how much... What was the nature of the school? To characterize the school,
the program
in the 60s were pretty interesting in terms of the campus expansion and new buildings every year.
That's right.
What was the atmosphere? And how much of that did you pay any attention to or not?
That much. We were in what was the life sciences building. That had just been built when I came in as a student, I think, around that time.
Okay.
Up to that time, we were in a building that was that's now been torn, long since been torn down, that was right across Federal from Old Main Building.
Okay.
I forgot the name of it.
Chapin
Hall, yes. Yeah. That's where the psych department was
Oh, okay.
until life sciences was built.
Yeah.
In fact, the peculiar design of the second floor of Life Sciences, with those little corridors in the middle and those strange rooms.
Yes, yes.
Those all had one-way mirrors. That was for counseling. And it was the psychology department that helped design that.
Oh, interesting.
Hmm.
And that's why it looks like that.
Yeah, yeah. Those sort of anecdotes are...
Yeah.
Can't find them anywhere else.
Yeah. The teaching style was a little bit unorthodox in some ways. Maury Adermann had been a stand-up comic before he became a psychologist. And he was like a classic New York comedian. Hmm. And I took several courses from him, and we became good friends. But half the courses were
jokes
and routines. But he was brilliant. Then he'd come in and out of the door, he'd give a lecture that was just incredible. There were other faculty there who were wonderful. Mary Vermillion, I took some courses from her. She was just wonderful. I'd say a completely positive, pleasant, and very profound learning experience at IIT, all the way around. Bob Roth taught one course that I'll never forget. This could never happen today, ever. But the course was on group dynamics. It was a room about this size, maybe a little smaller, in a Life Sciences building, the classroom. There were maybe 12, 15 students in the room, all of us graduate students. And we had a textbook. And the course was group dynamics. And the first day of class, Bob looks around the room, takes attendance, closes the attendance book, and says, "Okay, we're a group." He then proceeds to say nothing for the rest of the class. He doesn't answer questions. He doesn't make any facial expressions. He responds to nothing, no gestures. It was like a statue. Okay? After class, asked him about it. He wouldn't talk about it. He wouldn't talk about it with anybody. Okay? The next week, the same thing. The next week, the same thing. After class, he was just usual stuff, anything else. But about this class, he never said one word.
In the class. How many people dropped out right away?
Well, nobody dropped out, strangely enough. Today, this would never happen today. They'd sue the school today.
Right.
This went on almost till midterms. You can just imagine what this class went through. And we decided maybe we should choose who should be leader for the week, or maybe we should have to do this, do that. We tried all kinds of different things. Nothing worked, of course. We asked them all kinds of stuff. Never responded. By about at least a third of the way through the semester, we were all ready to kill him.
Right.
I mean, we were furious. We talked about it outside of class, and we decided to confront him. And we did, just before midterms. We confronted him full blast. And then he talked. He listened to what we had to say. And then he proceeded to talk about the dynamics of this group from the first class. He pointed out what groups go through, the subconscious issues, the kind of subconscious contracts group make, the role of the leader, which he said is in part a scapegoat for individual responsibility. How do you like that? He talked about the progression of us finally forming a contract to demand the leader. And all this stuff was beyond brilliant. It was beyond brilliant. We all walked out of there seeing stars. The rest of the semester, we went to the textbook. But when we discussed all of the concepts of group dynamics, we had a common experience emotionally that we could share. It meant something.
Right.
It wasn't just an intellectual number of theories. I'll never forget that in my life.
You had a trauma you could explore.
I will never forget that experience. I learned more about groups from that class than anything else I've ever done or that's happened to me. It was beyond remarkable. And as I said, this would never happen today.
What was the name of the course? Do you remember?
A group Dynamics.
Group Dynamics, yeah. Course. So, okay, yeah. It's being the world. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That is one of my major memories. and one joke that Maury Aderman told. We got into a discussion in class about what's normal. Because, you know, in my field, we always talk about what's not normal. and he was characteristically silent as we started arguing among ourselves. And finally he looked up and said, listen, all of you are wrong. Normal is a quality that every person has that disappears when you get to know them better. In my mind, that's still the best definition I've ever heard. Anyway, so that was that the president in those years was Retaliata.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So between my graduation and 1977, I'm doing a variety of things. I started a private practice, which I actually have maintained through this whole period. I still have a small, very small practice. I'm not doing much now, but it may pick up. As I said, I worked for these pediatricians. I worked part-time for the State of Illinois Department of Mental Health, which was really interesting. And in some of the hospitals, these were the years they used to have all these thousands of people housed for years in these like big mental institutions. Mm-hmm. And I started working for them just after the era where they pushed them all out into the community. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people you see on the street now would have been in those hospitals in those years.
Sure.
And our job with the team I was with was to monitor the care that ex-mental patients got in the licensed shelter care homes. Mm-hmm. We couldn't even get into the, and they were bad enough. Mm-hmm. We closed down a couple of them, in fact. So I had a good varied experience, you know, working with the pediatricians and working, you know, with the Department of Mental Health. I taught a little bit. Mm-hmm. Then in 77, I got hired full-time to be counseling center director. Now, the center was in Far Hall. We had two interns. It was not part of the psychology department.
Okay.
There was no wellness center. It was a separate function of the university. By and large, we were seen here, I think, as a place to handle that very small fraction of a percent of our students who were severely emotionally disturbed. You know, it had clear mental problems of one kind or another. And we did that. I mean, we took some people to the hospital I saw one student have a schizophrenic breakdown. I'll never forget it. We got him to the hospital emergency room, mm-hmm. and he was crawling around barking like a dog. And I really saw some strange stuff, as well as some students who had really some real problems. So, but it was a small percentage of the student body. And I noticed along the way that there wasn't very much being done for the general body of students. Mm-hmm. So all that you're going to read about some of that in that notebook I gave you, mm-hmm. where I started a whole bunch of workshops now and then, and I had no budget for it. Mm-hmm. They gave me space in Herman Hall, and I could get notices in the school paper. Mm-hmm. Study skills, dealing with stress, preparing for tests, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything like that around here. I started it all on a shoestring.
Yeah. Just a quick question. Is this all under the general aegis of the dean
counseling
of students?
Center.
Is that under the...
No, that was under the Jody Friedland, the dean of counseling services.
Okay. Who would report to...
Yeah, I think he reported to the dean of students.
Okay. Just wanted to see who that was.
Yeah.
and that was James. Yeah. I forget his name. We actually have his papers.
Jim Weiss.
Yes, we've got his papers.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
He's
still around. Really?
At
least 3-4 years ago when he gave us this stuff,
he gave
us like 8 or 9 boxes.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever run into him again, say hello.
Okay. Yeah.
Jim was a good guy. Uh-huh. Anyway, so starting that was very important. I got mm-hmm. 2 interns every year from the psychology department that I trained.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a small staff, and as I said, I was also doing work for IPS, doing the career counseling stuff, and I got into that pretty heavily too.
Yeah.
So I was pretty busy in those years. So that was from 77 to 86. Now, there were a few incidents that stand out in my mind
mm-hmm.
that I'd like to share with you mm-hmm. in those years. Because the day-to-day stuff is pretty predictable, but...
Mm-hmm.
One of them is I get a call from Jody, and he says, "Can you come down to Dr. Fairborn's office? We have a student who is, we've interviewed him, and there's something wrong. We can't figure it out. Can you interview him?" I said, "Sure." So I get down there. What's the story? Well, here's the story. This student came in that morning. He lived off campus alone. He had his own apartment,
mm-hmm.
and he had a part-time job in Herman Hall, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of Herman Hall in those years was Russ Johnson. Yeah, good guy.
Okay.
Could be very, very tough, anyway. And this kid was supposed to show up at 9 a.m., and he never showed.
Mm-hmm.
So Russ calls him up after about an hour, and the kid was incoherent. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sounded like he was drunk. Russ told me. He said, "You're a drunk or on drugs or something."
Mm-hmm.
So he laid down the law. He said, "Listen, you get your so-and-so in here, or you're losing this job, and you're going to..." He read him the Riot Act.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow his kid showed up and sat down, and Russ talked to him for a few minutes and recognized something was not right. He was just incoherent. He was talking strange. So he sends him over to Dr. Fairborn's office. Now, these are before the days where you could press a button and get medical records,
mm-hmm.
of course.
Mm-hmm.
So Fairborn does a clinical exam,
mm-hmm.
and then he clearly sees the same thing here. He didn't see anything clinically, you know, but he didn't have his records yet, but he didn't see anything clinically that looked like anything.
Mm-hmm.
So he called Jody. Mm-hmm. Jody, who was a licensed clinical psychologist like me, comes over, interviews this kid, and he can't figure it out either.
Hmm.
Me, I've worked at mental hospitals. I've
mm-hmm.
seen, you wouldn't believe what I've seen.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They could. That's why they called me.
Yeah.
So I get this story. I sit down with this kid, and it was very strange. He couldn't put a sentence together of more than 5 or 6 words without changing the topic entirely.
Hmm.
And he was earnestly trying to tell me something. So I walked out of the room, and they said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Listen, I have no idea what this is, but I think he belongs in a hospital."
Mm-hmm.
So we got a campus police to come over,
mm-hmm.
and I went with the student,
mm-hmm.
got in the car, and as we're getting in the car, Dr. Fairborn comes running out, and he said, "I just found his medical records. He's diabetic."
Mm.
He wasn't taking his insulin.
Oh, okay. Huh.
So we go to the emergency room, and I sat with him while I properly medicated him, and I saw something I never saw before or since.
Uh-huh.
I watched his brain come back.
Oh, okay.
Hmm. Slowly. And the doctors there told me, had he not been brought in, had he been left in that room,
mm-hmm.
in his room, mm-hmm. in his dorm, he would have gone into a coma, and he would have died.
Sure.
They said, "You saved his life." I said, "It wasn't me."
Mm.
When I got back to campus, I walked into Russ Johnson's office in Herman Hall, and I gave him a big hug.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I said, "You saved that kid's life by forcing him to..." I don't know how he got here.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But that's one of my biggest memories.
Sure.
From those years. Wow. Here's another big memory.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I get a phone call.
Uh-huh.
"Is this Sandra Marcus?" I said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. He said, "This is Marvin Camrus," who by then was, I think, emeritus professor. I don't remember the exact year, but it was around 1980, mm-hmm. maybe his late 70s. Mm-hmm. I said, nearly fell off my chair. "Dr. Camrus, what do I owe this honor?" Uh-huh. He said, "Somebody told me you play the violin." I said, "Well, I'm an amateur, but I take it seriously." Mm-hmm. He said, "I'm an amateur violin maker." Hmm. Nobody still knows that here.
Uh-huh, yeah.
He said, "I make maybe one a year."
Oh, interesting.
"How would you like to do a program together?"
Hmm.
And I said, "Are you kidding?" So we did. We brought a number of different violins, including a number that he made.
Uh-huh.
And I played like one passage on each different fiddle, and we discussed the differences in sound. And we had we were in an auditorium style classroom, and it was filled.
Oh, wow.
And one of the people who came there was my old violin teacher from my Antioch days, who his name was Myron Cartman. He in those years was the chair of the string department at Northwestern. He was a budding concert violinist in his day and played all over the world. My violin is actually a direct copy of his. Mine cost me $500. His was a Guarnerius worth about $1.5 million, something like that. But anyway, but he was there, and that's another one of my highlights.
Okay, so this was opened up to the public,
it was within IIT. I guess a lot of people just showed up out of curiosity or whatever. You know, we have no music department, but.
Yeah. Never heard that about cameras.
I know. Who knew that?
Uh-huh.
Who knew that?
Huh. Back in the days when you were allowed to be quirky. You know?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, quirky. And
yeah, that's right. Course,
yeah.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Wow. So those were some of my fonder, more memorable things from those years as counseling center director.
Yeah. So how was working under Tom Martin?
That was fine.
Okay.
That was fine.
Yeah.
Except, in fact, when I was first hired,
mm-hmm.
I had a big meeting with the then provost, who was Sid Gorelnik.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this was a big deal, Sid meeting me. And so there were several people in the room. Jody was there, and I forgot who else was there, and Sid.
Mm-hmm.
And I expected to be kind of grilled or, have a big interview. And instead, Sid started talking. And I couldn't get a word in edgewise. I mean, he was good, but couldn't get a word in edgewise. And and a lot of what he talked about was how he had helped students and about faculty had helped students when they had problems. A student came to him and said, "I can't get anything done." And he'd say, "Look, there are only so many hours in a day, and you'd have so many hours to sleep and go to class, and you got to plan your time." And I managed to get in a couple of words. I said, sometimes that's all it takes.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me. He did I'll never forget this. He did a classic movie double take, like, "What?"
It's like
psychologists aren't supposed to make common sense,
I see.
And I, by the way, I'm a big believer in little things.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So I wasn't kidding. So he gave me such a big smile after that, and then he kept talking. I said very little during that meeting, and I heard later on that he was talking with, I think it was Tom Martin, who was the president at that time, and Martin asked him, "Hey, how's this guy, new guy Marcus?" And Sid, what I heard, said, "Oh, he's really got a head on his shoulders." And I'm trying to think, what did I say? Anyway, but that was fun. That was fun. Now, during those years, Institute for Psychological Services, we count career counsel, I'd say, from about third year high school up through retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people we saw were in mid-career.
Mm-hmm.
We also, it was a consulting firm also, it was a school, the Center for Research and Service. Does a lot of what IPS did in those years.
Mm-hmm.
We consulted to companies, hundreds,
mm-hmm.
And some very big ones.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest ones we had was Illinois Power Company, which in recent years has been sold, I think, to one of these big energy firms. Anyway, mm-hmm. and we did all of their evaluations for their management and for their primarily managers. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of evaluations of people they were hiring, especially in management roles. And I had a lot of experience doing that, and plus other companies we worked with, yeah. testing and interviewing, some training. Mm-hmm. So I got that under my belt, too, mm-hmm. yeah. In those years.
Wow. Just for the record, when you and I spoke a few weeks ago, yeah. you said for the entire history of that program was something like 45,000.
Here's when we left. Yeah. Here's mm-hmm. what happened. Mm-hmm. Jody was very active. He reported directly to, I think he may have reported directly to the president. I'm not sure, but he reported way up there. Yeah. IIT had decided for budgetary reasons to get rid of IPS. Hmm. And he and I, oh, I want to tell you one other story, but let me get back to this.
Yeah, yeah.
IPS gets a call from Dennis Hull. Remember Bobby Hull from the Blackhawks? Mm-hmm. Dennis mm-hmm. Hull was his brother. Mm. Dennis Hull was just as good a hockey player. Mm. He was retired. He was teaching at some small college. Mm. And he didn't know what to do for that. Now, I can talk about this legally because he made it a public record. Mm. I can't talk about anything, you know, anybody we saw. We saw some very famous people. I can't say anything about it because of Illinois Confidentiality Act. But I can about this.
Sure.
In fact, this was actually written up in Sports Illustrated, one issue. Hmm. It was a small issue that he talked about coming here to IIT and getting tested mm-hmm. for a career. Yeah. And Jody interviewed him, and I interviewed him. At that time, the, what's the name of this? You know, I'm sorry. I'm trying to remember everybody's name, and... I'll get it. Ed Glancy, of course.
Okay.
I remember Ed, too. Mm. Okay. It's now the building named after him. He was the head of athletics, and he was retiring that year. Okay. Again, late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. And just at about that time, Dennis Hull comes in for this testing and counseling, and Jody, who was as sharp as they come, could see that this guy would be fabulous, and not only because of his fame, mm-hmm. but as an athletic director. So he mm-hmm. talked to Tom Martin, mm-hmm. and within a few weeks, Dennis was hired. He was our athletic director here for 10 years because of IPS.
And Jody Friedland. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
And he was very funny. He had a great sense. I remember there was one graduation where I was sitting up in a row behind President Martin, Mr. Galvin, Mr. Pritzker, you know, all these big-time donors were right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And Dennis Hull is sitting next to me through the whole thing telling me jokes. And I'm biting my lip and, you know, trying not to laugh. And finally he looked at me and said, you're no fun. But at any rate... So getting back to this other story, IIT had decided that they were going to get rid of IPS. And Jody tried to argue them out of it. You know, he created that one year, based on the work with underachievers, a freshman advising program. He was in charge of it, freshman advising, I'm sorry. Yeah. He created that program which reduced the attrition rate at this university from first to second year by 13% in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And then they decide to get rid of the IPS.
Financial reasons or was...
Probably financial reasons, mm-hmm. okay.
Okay.
And he tried to, we talked about it. I was never directly involved in the negotiations about it, but he really tried to talk them out of it. Well, as it turned out, and that's when we got this data, that from 1945 to 1986, when this happened, IPS had career counseled about 45,000 individuals and had actively worked with about 400 companies, including the telephone company, you know, a major... energy company. I mean, manufacturers. Mm-hmm. I still get occasional calls from some of the companies we worked with. Mm-hmm. All right. And Jody said, like, how do you duplicate anything like this?
Yeah, right.
They still, budgetary issues, I guess, ruled the day that mm-hmm. year. And so he and I got together and said, and Jody had this great idea. He said, you know what? I'm going to ask mm-hmm. them, would you like to go into private practice with me? We'll form our own company. Mm-hmm. And we'll do the same work with the same companies. They're not going to do anything with them. And I said, great. So he negotiated with them, mm-hmm. and IIT gave us access to all of them. Mm. IIT, if individuals and companies called IIT asking for IPS experience, IIT referred them to us, Jody and me, to our firm. We called it Friedland and Marcus. Mm-hmm. That's how we became Friedland and Marcus.
Okay.
All right? That's in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So we could hit the ground running.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we had all the files. Do you know our files took, how much space our files took? Those were before the days of you could, you know, scan everything. Our
25 cabinets, I guess.
Well... If you think of a library with yeah. rows of books, this uh-huh. was rows of stuff, yeah. at about at least half, two-thirds of the basement of Far Hall uh-huh. were oh, all wow. our records. Hmm. And IIT agreed to store them for us. They stored them for us for a couple of years, I think. Hmm. Mm-hmm. They were wonderful to Jody and me. We thought they were making a mistake in terms of the university, uh-huh. but no complaint that they were wonderful to us. They couldn't have been better. They referred people to us. We literally hit the ground running. So we ran essentially what was our own little mini IPS for years after 86, for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And then in the meantime, I was on occasional boards for the psych department, you know, advisory boards and things like that. It wasn't very active, but I maintained contact. In 85 or so, 86, Jody retired. Yeah, because he's older than me mm-hmm. by about 9-10 years. mm-hmm. And he's doing fine. I talk to him mm-hmm. frequently, because also in the intervening years after we left IIT is when I wrote my books. Jody and I and the late Harvey Mandel created some tests that are still in the published. And so at that particular time, 86, the psych department had gotten this contract with Chicago Public Schools. In fact, you can talk to Ellen Mitchell about this, because she was chair of the department in those years. Mm-hmm. And they got this. Are you familiar with this project? It's for the gifted program.
It, yeah.
Okay, uh-huh. Here's what it is. Mm-hmm. The Chicago Public Schools has special gifted programs throughout their system. Mm-hmm. To get into the programs, you have to pass tests to do it, admissions tests. Mm-hmm. The contract for those admissions tests came to IIT.
Okay.
We got it.
The Institute of Psychology.
Well, in those years, it was the Institute of Psychology, yeah. but the psychology department,
yeah, right.
essentially.
Yeah. Right.
And since I had all this work, you know, for 2 years when I was the... working with the pediatricians, this was in Lake Forest, mm-hmm. For two of those years, I did all these psych evaluations for the Lake Forest school system. Mm-hmm. I did it for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but I had a lot of experience with schools and with the work with achievement issues. This seemed, and all the testing and mm-hmm. my previous work, you know, with IIT, this seemed like a natural, you know. So as Jody retired, I was rehired here at IIT.
Okay.
In about 2006.
Okay.
And they said the director of the Center for Research and Service was in Bruce Fisher. So he hired me.
Okay.
And Bruce I also know because he was also a graduate into this program. Anyway, we only tested pre-kindergarten kids through seventh graders, but for the entire Chicago public school system. And only that was a four-month period, still is, for 4 months, from the beginning of November through the end of February. The first year, in that four-month period, we tested about 6,000 kids. The pre-kindergartners had have to be tested individually. All the others from kindergarten through seventh grade were tested in groups. Okay? 6,000 kids in 4 months. If you during those winter months see families wandering around here with little kids all the time, that's what that is. That's that program. It's still going on.
Oh, okay.
Okay? I was the on-site supervisor for the entire program for its first 10 years until I was transferred over to career counseling.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
Each year, the number of kids we tested grew. My last year, it was over 16,000 kids. It's now about, I think this year, past year or two, it was about 17,000.
Okay, so that's 2006 to 2016.
That's correct.
Okay, wow. All right. Wow. Yeah, indeed.
And that job required more than full-time hours on weekends for those 4 months. If I kept track of my hours here, I'd be a millionaire for those years. Yeah. Plus other things for the center, career counseling, a lot of career counseling, and other odd things here and there. I think I did a little bit of teaching. I still go in occasionally and we'll do one class for a professor on some topic, resumes or whatever it might be.
Oh, okay.
So that was that 10 years, and it was, as you can imagine, very busy. I worked directly with the director of special programs for the Chicago Public Schools, Angela Washington. Okay. We became good friends, and I got to know some of their staff, and that was a great association.
Way to be busy into your 70s.
Oh, you said it. You said it. And then I came to work for career counseling service here, and then I had an illness last year. Not an illness. There was a family situation, and I had to take some time off, and I also took a fall. I tripped on something. Bang, I fractured my wrist. Long story. Yeah. So I had about 2 months off.
Okay.
And at that point, I looked at Chris and I said, considering my age and everything else,
you're done.
I think I'm done, but not completely yet. Yeah. I mean, I'm not done now, but nothing like, So I cut back to halftime.
Okay.
And then I worked out something with George where I just worked my hours down. Until 3 months ago, I formally retired. They gave me a wonderful luncheon. This school gave me my career direction. It gave me my marriage. It gave me my competence. It gave me overcoming a disability I didn't even know I had. It gave me everything, and it gave me the best friends I've ever had in my life. And that is essentially my IIT story.
Marvelously sculptured presentation.
Well, let's see. If I had anything else in my notes I wanted to mention.
And you also.
Harry Hershenson was such a wonderful man. Now, he and my mother were not married when he married Chris and me. We were married in his courtroom. He married her a few months after that, I think. But... He, while he was on the bench, and he was known by mayors, archbishops, and I would occasionally go to his courtroom and watch him in court, and we'd go have lunch. And we'd go in the elevator in the Daly Center that only the judges could go in. And of course, I went in, and I got to meet all these famous judges. You're reading the paper, and they were so friendly to him. He'd introduce me as his son. I mean, I was so touched. And he was really a wonderful guy. And anyway.
Great associations, great connections.
Oh, my goodness. And the marriage he had with my mother was just wonderful. Anyway, a week before he died, he was on his deathbed. We were talking about the meaning of life. Here's a guy who had everything, I mean everything in his life, who had met challenges you can't believe, had a certain level of fame in areas unparalleled. And I said to him, Harry, if in my lifetime I achieve 1/1,000th of what you have, I'd consider myself very successful. And I'll never forget this. He looked at me, this is 1981. He looked at me and he said, Sandy, let me tell you what success is in life. When all is said and done, you are only as good as your word. How do you like that? I get that written down on the inside of my eyelids.
It's true.
So my story, really, of my life is very much an IIT story.
Yeah, appreciate that, and that you mentioned that you gave credit and acknowledgement to all the different people and the sequencing of it and whatnot.
There's usually a point at the end where if we ask if there's anything that we haven't talked about that's you came prepared.
No need for that.
Well, I really, this opportunity gave me a chance to really think about a lot of stuff.
Good.
Yeah, most of the people we've interviewed have been at the point of retirement,
of course,
it's an ideal time to,
do it.
Of course, you are thinking those things through.
That's correct. That's correct. I really appreciate the opportunity to have done this, and now I can tell you a few other things about my career and my life that you may not know, that don't necessarily have to do with IIT, but I've been a big lover of classical music, especially violin music, ever since I can remember. I can remember sitting on my dad's knee in orchestra hall. And I was sitting on his knee because I was about 4 years old. I remember it. And it was Isaac Stern playing the Tchaikovsky violin concerto. And while I have only vague glimmers of a picture of it in my brain, my memory, visual memory issue is a problem. I remember passages of exactly how he played. I mean, it's like a recording in my brain. I have entire Brahms symphonies, and I can't see a note of music in my mind. But concertos. And I remember, I knew the piece at four, age of four, so music. So I've seen a lot of the great musicians, the great violinists, Heifetz, Milstein. Saw his last concert in Chicago. He was 80 years old, and he played unbelievably. And I also saw, I have to share a couple of anecdotes with you about the music. I don't know if you remember a famous British conductor named Sir Thomas Beecham. I'm sure you do. I heard him conduct in 1960, the year before he died. And he was known for his wit. And at the concert, it was a Chicago Symphony. It was an orchestra hall. And he was very frail, you could tell. They had a stool on the stage for him. And I think he walked with a cane. Anyway, and he was very popular with musicians. And the orchestra really played for him, and they were great. I still remember some of the pieces and performances. Anyway, after every piece, he would motion the orchestra to stand. And then after they got a big applause, he'd stand and turn around and take a modest little bow. That was it. After about the third encore, he motioned the orchestra to stand and they all refused, and they all motioned him to stand.
Oh, okay.
It was one of those wonderful moments. I remember there were people near me crying. And he turned around, and he quieted everybody down after this applause. Mm-hmm. And out of this frail body came this booming voice with this aristocratic British accent. And he said, "You know, you have a wonderful orchestra here in Chicago, but there's one thing they haven't learned: obedience." things like that you never forget.
They really stick with you. And, real touchstones.
But anyway, thank you again for this opportunity. It gave me a chance to think back and recall and you know, some of these things, and I'm glad I got a chance to get this all in. And I do feel one of the things that that for me, especially at this point in my life, is to pass the baton. Mm-hmm. I've been doing that professionally with the students I deal with and work with. And I feel like I'm doing that here too.
Oh yeah, there's very much a philosophic aspect to this.
I'll bet.
Program we're doing.
And I'm a big fan of quotes, and I like writing quotes. And by the way, speaking of humor again, about 25 years, 30 years ago, I took about, my dad was a newspaper man, and he wrote comedy. Also, he wrote some screenplays, never got anywhere with him, but he was a very talented writer. But all I remember as a kid is jokes and puns flying across the dinner table back and forth. And I've written some things, and I take comedy pretty seriously. I'm not a comic. The thought of getting up in front of people just to make them laugh is terrifying. But in all the talks and teaching I've done, I always throw
more
in humor.
I always throw in some humor.
But one year, I decided I would literally try to write gags, one-liners, jokes for cartoonists and comedians. I did it literally every day for a half hour to an hour for a year, literally a full year, and I burnt out.
Before you burned out, whom did you supply?
Well, nobody famous with one exception. I sold about 3 dozen gags to Joan Rivers.
All right.
And what was really interesting was she bought only the clean ones. I didn't expect that. But
Wow. This is like in the 80s?
Sometime around then. I don't remember exactly. So anyway, I've always taken that kind of seriously. And with that, I'll tell you another Beecham story, which has to do with education.
Okay.
A woman comes up to him and she says, "I have this young son, he's 4 or 5 years old, and I want to start him on a musical instrument. But I hate the way they sound the first year, the sound they make, until they learn how to make a decent sound. So could you suggest a suitable instrument?" And he said, "Yes, the bagpipes." And she said, "Why the bagpipes?" And he said, "Because they sound exactly the same after you learn how to play them."
It's true, there's no curve there.
Right.
Changing experience.
But getting back to quotes, one of my quotes, and this is something in my training, and I take some pride in this, for training any of the students and supervisees I've been lucky to have worked with, my mantra has always been that you are a professional based on how you behave and how you react and how you interact and how you communicate. You are not a professional based on how you are treated by others. And the most important time to behave and communicate like a professional is when you're not being treated like one. That's when it counts.
Oh my goodness, yes. Well, we all fall short of that. Most of us fall short of that.
We're all human. Uh-huh, I mean, that's nobody's perfect.
Right.
Let me modify that. Uh-huh. I have never made a mistake. I thought I did once, but I was wrong. So.
with that, we'll
call it
off the record.
Anyway, thank you so much. Thank you guys. This was great.
Yeah.